Okay, good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Leanne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Leanne.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. So this evening we are beginning here after our Supper and a Speaker, so we're going to be at step one. And if you'll help me welcome our panel, we've got Joe and Maggie. So I'm going to read the first paragraph. We're starting tonight in the doctor's opinion, which will be XXV1, if you want to follow along if you have your book. And then the panel is going to share for a few minutes on each reading. So step one, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we are maladjusted to life, that we are in full flight from reality, or we're outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. We're going to start with Maggie.
Hey, I'm Maggie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Maggie.
I'll qualify a little bit because I think I'm supposed to. My sobriety date is June 24th, 2014. I have a home group, I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. When I first came into the program, I didn't really know. I didn't know anything about the physical allergy. I'd never heard of that. I didn't really know what an alcoholic was. And I certainly didn't think that I was one for most of my drinking years. I started drinking when I was 11, and I came into the program when I was 26. And, you know, that's been most of my life. And I didn't know anything else when I got sober. I didn't know what life looked like without drinking and using. Because I don't really remember a whole lot before age 11 anyway. So everything, every experience I had, drinking and drugs were involved. And even though I got into a lot of trouble and found myself in a lot of sticky situations, you know, that's not what I thought being an alcoholic was. When if you said alcoholic to me, I would have thought, you know, after school special, like someone going into the DTs from like meth or something, like something really extreme. I was like, I don't look like that. You know, when I came into the program, you know, I had a job and a husband and an apartment, and yeah, I really didn't think that I was an alcoholic. But when I started reading the book, it became very, very clear to me that I was, because this explanation of the physical allergy explained many things for which I could not otherwise account. And it was the biggest relief in the world to me when I started reading this chapter. Because, like it says in this paragraph, it didn't satisfy me to be told that my drinking was because I was maladjusted, that I was just a bad person. I mean, I was maladjusted. and I did think that I was a terrible person, but I kept looking for another answer. And I saw doctors and therapists, and I looked for medication, and I tried, you know, I need uppers, I need downers, I need something, I need more liquor, I need, you know... I was constantly trying to figure out what it was that was wrong with me, why I behaved the way that I did, why I couldn't stop drinking, why, you know, I pushed everything else aside and always prioritized getting lit. And the word allergy, I feel like, is kind of, it can be misleading, but as part of my homework when I first started working this step, I had to look it up in the dictionary. And Webster says that an allergy is a condition of unusual sensitivity to a substance which in like amounts does not affect others and is characterized by systematic disorder. Well, I absolutely have a different reaction than other people who in like amounts, you know, do not do the things that I do and do not feel the way that I feel. And yeah, I mean, that was enough explanation for me. This is really the part of the book that kind of galvanized me into believing, oh my God, like, this is what it is. Like, I'm not bipolar. I'm not a total moral degenerate. I'm an alcoholic. And that was actually a huge relief. I was psyched about it because, you know, then I could figure out, okay, what is the actual solution? Which if you keep reading the book, it's in there. So that's all I have.
Thank you.
I am Joe. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 10th, 2014. And I, too, have a sponsor and sponsor some guys. This program has completely changed my life. When I first came into the program for about 6 months prior to getting sober, I was constantly trying to figure out why I was a narcissist. And I had even looked it up, the definition, done some reading on it, trying to figure out, you know, where I went wrong. And eventually I was getting to the point where I was pretty content to come to that conclusion that there's something so seriously wrong with me mentally that I couldn't figure out how to even care about other people other than myself. My self-centeredness had gotten to that degree. And I was actually, you know, I was beginning to get okay with it until I went into rehab and started learning about this allergy thing. And it made complete sense to me. And as I was doing it, learning about it, people pointed out different things, you know, to clue me in that I did have this allergy, because I certainly didn't want it, because that was the only, alcohol was the only thing that prevented me from completely freaking out about my chronic narcissism, you know, because I had a slogan probably the last year that absolutely everything that can be done in life is better drunk. You know, so I would get up in the morning, drink, go to work. My first break would come, and I'd start to be losing my buzz. So I would drink at break, then drink at lunch, and then drink at afternoon break. And then on the way home, I figured out that Mountain Dew bottle hid the color of beer quite well, so I could finish off a 40 in my 10-minute drive from home, or from work to home. And then in the evening, I would drink until I got to a point where I was ready to call it quits, and then that's when I'd really get drunk. And it was my counselor in rehab laughed at me one time. He's like, "Boy, it sounds like it was an awful lot of work for you to drink," because all day long I had to regulate how much I was drinking because I wanted to have just enough to have a buzz, but I couldn't drop below it because at that point I'd started developing DTs that she read about in, or saw in the after school special. And I knew that if I got my blood alcohol content dropped enough, then there's a high probability that I would seizure because I'd already done that several times. So I had to regulate and enjoy, and at the same time try to observe other people's reactions to how I was acting and how I was talking, because then I could try to minimize the fact that I was drunk all day long. But then I started reading about the allergy and studying on the allergy, and they told me different things that really clued me in that, wow, I think I do have this. You know, the phenomenon of when you're at a restaurant and the guy at the table next to you gets up and leaves this much left in his beer, and you just feel an urge to get up and grab that beer before the busboy gets it and slam it. You know, that's the allergy in action. You know, when you're at a bar drinking with your buddies and you have a pitcher, and all of a sudden you realize that you've drank two glasses and he hasn't even finished his first, and you're kind of panicking because you want another beer, but you don't really want to, you know, have a third beer before that guy even finishes his first. So what do you do? What do you do? And your mind races. All of a sudden you come up with a solution. I know, I'll top off his beer and then fill mine. And that sounds perfectly great to you. And you get a sense of peace, you know, because you can reload your beer. That was the allergy in action. And I never really realized I had it until probably 3 months sober. And I went to a bar and grill one time for dinner, and I looked around the room and I was like, holy cow, there's not everybody in here is drinking. That is so strange. I'd never noticed that before, you know? And then I started looking at the tables, and it was pretty common that people didn't finish their beer. And I'd never noticed that before. You know, apparently if you drink like a person without allergy, your beer gets warm before you get done with the glass. You know, I didn't know that that existed until I started learning about the allergy. But then it started to make sense, you know. Now that I've kind of identified the problem, then there's a potential solution. Because the truth was, I wasn't a narcissist. I was an alcoholic. And when you're trying to diagnose, or when you're trying to treat yourself for the wrong problem, you're never going to find the solution. That was the cool part about reading the doctor's opinion. Thank you.
All right, thanks. All right, we're going to continue on page Roman numeral 28, XXP111. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and they become astonishingly difficult to solve.
So this phrase, phenomenon of craving, this is one of the phrases in the book that, like, the first time I read it, it's this phrase and pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, where, I mean, it just struck such a chord the first time I read it. I was like, that, yes, that's the thing that I've been trying to define, the phenomenon of craving. And a phenomenon is something you can see but not explain. And I mean, not just the craving was a phenomenon, but like the behavior, the peculiar mental twist, it was all just like such a phenomenon to me. when I walked in these doors. I was baffled by, you know, the way I behaved around alcohol. As soon as I had a drink, I mean, from the very first drink, I swallowed it, and it was like every little neuron, every little cell was like, hello, I'm awake. And that was a wonderful feeling in the beginning. And then I remember reading this for the first time and pinpointing really when that phenomenon of craving and the reaction of that physical allergy like just turned on me. It didn't bother me for many, many years that I drank a lot and I acted ridiculous. Like, I thought it was like a charming little personality trait that, like, I was wild, I was bad, and like I kind of dug it. And shortly before I came into the program, I did a 6-month white knuckle stint. Because although my husband also didn't really know what an alcoholic was, he was pretty sure that I was one. And I was going to prove that I wasn't. So I didn't pick up a drink for 6 months. And it was horrible. And I remember thinking, you know what? Like, it was the day before I was going to get to have my first drink. I proved everybody wrong. And I really believed it. I was like, clearly, I don't have a problem. And I thought, I'm going to be such a lightweight. I'm going to get drunk off like 2 drinks because I haven't had, you know, I've lost all my tolerance. And I ordered a big drink and I took one sip and all those neurons woke up again. But this time, instead of like happiness and joy, it was like anxiety and fear of like, oh my God, like I need more and I might not get it. And I don't think this is working and this is horrible. And that was how I felt. It only took about 4 or 5 weeks for me to walk in the doors of these rooms after that moment. Because from that point on, my life was the phenomenon of craving. It was constantly, oh my God, he didn't fill my drink up enough. How am I going to sneak another bottle into the bathroom? What am I going to do at this party? I'm staying in a hotel and running down to the bar while my spouse is in the shower and taking shots and then running back up. I mean, just craziness, absolute craziness. And, you know, that's what happens with one drink. I mean, one sip of one drink. And I have circled in my book the word never. Never, never. And I was just having this conversation with my sponsor about this line that these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Like, I don't know how much it takes. And this word never to me means surrender. Surrender, like I'm waving my white flag at alcohol because I don't know what it is that makes me have this allergy, but I know that it can happen with one sip of a drink. There is no, you know, I mean, I tried having just one or having just, you know, wine or have, you know, no shots, and none of those things worked. It's any form at all. And there are lots of things out there that have alcohol in them that are not marketed as alcohol. Like, my mother-in-law constantly buys me O'Doul's because she thinks that it's okay, and I always decline it. But there's other stuff out there that has alcohol in it, and you know, it was really just brought to my attention this week that, you know, maybe that's dangerous. Maybe that's not a good idea, because this says in any form at all. And, you know, if one sip of, you know, a martini can send me over the edge, like, who knows what else can? I don't really know. And for me, those decisions, I mean, that's part of the surrender. And I didn't think about that when I first came in. It's taken a lot of work in the steps to start, you know, being open to those kind of ideas. But, you know, if I don't surrender even now, you know, years away from a drink, my problems still pile up on me and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And if I'm not actively, you know, doing work in this book and you know, connecting with a power greater than myself, then my problems pile up on me and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's unmanageability. You know, that's what step one says. I cannot manage my own life. And but since I came here and started listening to what you guys have to tell me, you know, I don't necessarily have to manage my own life, thank God, because I'm not very good at it. So, thanks.
I like the part where it says, once having formed the habit, they found they cannot break it. That was one thing that was really difficult for me to grasp at first, because I liked the idea of not drinking for a while, getting my tolerance down, and then being able to drink like I did at the beginning. Because I was pretty slow in developing my alcoholism. 3 years of college, just partied on the weekend, you know, and when we went out to party, me and my two buddies, we'd split a case and have beer left over at the end of the night. You know, my senior year, it was down to me and a buddy splitting a case and still having beer left over. The first several years after I got out of college, you know, I'd come home and have two or three beers in an evening, and be totally good with that. And then, you know, at that point I was mainly drinking because it was fun, you know. But then later on, you know, I made a switch where instead of drinking for fun, I drank because it helped me unwind. And then I drank because it helped me relax for when crappy things happened. And then later on, it was a drinking to forget about things and numb pain. And I would specifically drink to numb pain and frustration about how life was going. And then later on, it was just drinking for oblivion, and finally ended with drinking to survive. And you know, it was really hard for me to accept the fact that those first 8 years, once having formed the habit, those first 8 years will never ever happen again. Because whatever neurons or whatever activation this allergy has. I know I've talked to some people, the allergy got activated the first drink. Other people, it takes a long time. And for the people that it takes a long time, sometimes it's really hard for us to believe that we are an alcoholic, because we remember times when we drank like that other person at the who actually had their beer get warm. You know, we think, well, maybe we're just out of control, so we just need to back off a little bit. Or maybe we need to have more self-discipline or more willpower. And the truth is, once the phenomenon of craving sets in, it's in there forever. You know, and it's an unfortunate act, because, you know, I don't so much anymore, because I've seen the benefits of this program and actively working it. But the first year, you know, I always had fond memories of the wonderful times of drinking, and if only I could go back to that time frame. And, you know, I almost like going through a grieving process that I couldn't drink, which is very real, by the way. But the fact is that once that habit has been formed, you know, I can't go back. But the beautiful part is we have this program that gets us a life way better than what it was, even when we were able to drink two or three drinks and let our beer get warm.
All right, we're going to continue on the same page. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others take with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
So here it's telling me why I drink, because I like the effect produced by alcohol. That is so true, I do. But there were so many effects produced by alcohol, and it could morph into whatever I needed it to be. If I was, you know, ready to party, it would go there with me. If I, you know, wanted to sit alone and drink bourbon in the dark and smoke cigarettes, it would be melancholy with me. And you know, it's the effect of alcohol was everything that I wanted. And yeah, it gave me the ease and comfort that I needed in every situation, whether I was uncomfortable because of you or I was uncomfortable because of me. Like, it didn't matter. I got the ease and comfort that I needed. And, you know, it says right here in this paragraph that I will drink again unless I have a new solution for my inability to be uncomfortable. Because I cannot stand being uncomfortable. I think that it will kill me to be uncomfortable. In any way, in a big way, in a small way, I'm constantly sort of taking my temperature to make sure I'm okay. Am I feeling the best I can feel right now in this moment at work? Am I excited about my job? Am I feeling fulfilled? If not, like, I'm going to dwell on that. I'm going to spend my whole day. I'm not going to focus on anyone or anything else that needs to be focused on because I am uncomfortable. And the cool thing is that now I don't need a drink to do that. When I feel uncomfortable, this program has given me the tools I need to actually function in the world without being so self-obsessed with my uncomfortability. And that only happens because of an entire psychic change. Right, and that's the result of these steps and nothing else. It's a promise here that you're going to have an entire psychic change, and that's going to give you the solution, the ease and comfort that you're always looking for. If I don't have another solution, I need to drink because I can't handle being that uncomfortable. I love this line about they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. It took me a long time, like a lot of reads through this, to sort of understand what that meant. I was like, I understand the true from the false. But this is me saying it'll be different this time. Like, that's not true. While I admit it is injurious, I can't differentiate that actually it's not going to be different this time. Like, all the bad stuff that has happened, it's going to happen again this time. But, like, me in my alcoholic mind, like, I can't see that. I'm completely blinded by my desire to drink. And then here at the bottom of the page, they are restless, irritable, and discontented. Yeah, that's me. I mean, that's untreated alcoholism. And I didn't have to think about my restlessness or irritability or discontentedness when I was drinking. And now, if I'm not working a program and expanding my spiritual life, I still get restless, irritable, and discontent regularly because, you know, I'm not always working this program to the best of my ability and actively expanding my spiritual life. And it shows. It shows up, like, all over my life. It shows up when I'm living in untreated alcoholism because I'm an alcoholic whether I have a drink or not. I may not be experiencing the phenomenon of craving anymore, but being restless, irritable, and discontent, like, I don't need a drink for that. That's the disease that lives on without a drink, and that's why I have to keep coming back. Thanks.
Thank you. Because they like the effect produced by alcohol, when I was 22 years old, I was at my grandparents' house, and my family was very anti-drinking. Not like in your face, yell at you, but nobody touched the stuff, and they looked down on people that did. And me and my cousin were roommates in college, and we were doing the casual drinking thing. And the topic came up at Christmas dinner, after dinner, when we were all sitting around the living room. I can actually even remember where I was sitting. But the topic of drinking came up, and of course, you know, me being the budding alcoholic I was, I got really offended, and I said, you know, why do people do anything? We drink because we like how it makes us feel. Almost literally quoted that line, you know, some, you know, 10 to 15 years before I quit drinking or even heard of this book. You know, I'm like, why do you try to do good at work? You know, and I even said, why do you guys have sex? Because it feels good, right? And And it's so amazing after working on the program to look back at the folly on that statement, but it was really real. Everything I did was about making me feel good, because the solution to me and the uncomfortableness I felt and the fear I felt was always outside myself. You know, it was always something I needed to ingest, something I needed to do, something I needed to have, and I was never good enough. And the only time that stuff would go away was when I would start drinking, and I liked the way it made me feel, you know, period. And I even defended it as a logical reason to drink. And I wish I could, you know, be a non-alcoholic to hear how dumb that statement sounds, but I can't, because it's still kind of science, kind of logical to me. But the results of that drinking are horrible. So, the other thing, the sense of ease and comfort, which comes by taking a few drinks. Sometimes my ease and comfort would actually come before I even touched a drink. You know, I can remember, you know, be a Friday afternoon or a Tuesday afternoon or Saturday morning, you know, and just, okay, yeah, I'm going to get a drink tonight. You know, I'm going to get effed up, you know, the stupid things that we say when we're looking forward to drinking, and, you know, getting, you know, nervous and pacing, and then, you know, oh, I got to have one. And I'd pull into the convenience store and it'd start to decrease. And as soon as I got my hand on the bottle, that nervousness would go away. And, you know, buy it and then head to the car. And first thing I do is slam, you know, my Diet Coke and fill it up and mix one for the ride home. And just feeling, finally, you know. And that was something that I so look forward to. But I knew the terror that was going to come ahead of, or come right after that, but I really didn't care, because in my mind I could rationalize it all. It's amazing the power of rationalization as alcoholics develop. It says in the big book somewhere that most alcoholics are above average intelligence. Well, we got to be to come up with that many excuses. You know? So that was the sense of ease and comfort that I got from drinking.
Thank you. All right, we're going to go over to page 29, XXIX. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
So I had a lot of people tell me in the early days that I was an alcoholic. and I always said, no, I'm not, because I don't drink because I'm addicted to alcohol. I drink because I like to drink. So I really, you know, it took until that last month of drinking for me to really see that I was drinking because I had a craving beyond my mental control. But, you know, like we talked about in the previous paragraph, like, I wasn't able to see the truth about that at all. I see it very clearly now. but I really believed that, you know, I just drink excessively because I like to. And when people would ask me, you know, after, you know, a DUI or yet another underage drinking ticket or waking up with, you know, black eyes and one shoe and, like, on somebody's back porch and I don't know where I am, like, why do you drink so much? Because I like it. I love that stuff, right? Like, who doesn't love that stuff? You know, when I read this this line about making the supreme sacrifice rather than continuing to fight, like, the first thought that comes into my head is suicide, like making the supreme sacrifice instead of continuing to fight. And I definitely, like, when I first came into the program, I was probably a couple months in, And, you know, I realized that I had no coping mechanisms and I couldn't take it. I was too uncomfortable. And, you know, I saw several choices in front of me that I could either drink, which is what I really wanted to do, but also really didn't want to do, because by that time I was pretty sure I was an alcoholic. Or I could kill myself. That was the other option. Or I could take your suggestions and start to pray. Luckily, I decided to try prayer. But that suicide was a very real option for me. I just could not imagine living without a drink. But aside from suicide, you know, there are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause us to make the supreme sacrifice. And what that really means to me is, like, look at all the situations that I got myself into that were so dangerous and putting everything on the line. You know, it's by the time I was in eighth grade, I was drinking every day. I was bringing, you know, soda bottles full of liquor to school. And that kind of stuff continued, you know, through college. I mean, eventually I was out of school and I was like, yeah, I can do what I want, you know, and I didn't feel like I was sacrificing anything. But I was, you know, I was willing to get kicked out of school. I was willing to disappoint everyone. I was willing to drive drunk and risk my friends' lives and strangers' lives. And nothing really mattered to me. And as I got older, you know, I met the love of my life and got married. And, man, the stuff I put him through, like, it hurt so much to watch myself do these things to him. And yet, I kept doing them. You know, I was making so many sacrifices to continue drinking. It's shocking to me looking back. And at the time, I really didn't see it. I really couldn't see that it was related in any way to drinking. I really just thought that I was a terrible person. But that phenomenon of craving, like the book says, became paramount to all other interests. Nothing else mattered. Even though I wholeheartedly wanted it to. Yeah, I mean, this program has given me the tools to put other things first, you know. It wasn't just that, I mean, it was that I had a craving beyond my control, but it was also that, you know, my needs just were always first. I was not able to put anyone or anything else before my need to get drunk. Thanks.
Thanks. When I was drinking, I totally lived in an and world. And what I mean by that is I could drink like I did and be good at my job. I could drink like I did and be a great dad. I could drink like I did and be a good friend. I could drink like I did and be a great husband. And I was 100% believing in that idea. And I even found myself, when I would read articles on different people, every once in a while, I'd come across an article where they'd mention, you know, that this guy was a heavy drinker. And I'm like, see, he did it. That can be me, you know. And it just didn't dawn on me that my drinking was having negative effects on the rest of my life. You know, if things didn't go quite as good as I wanted to, or went completely opposite of how I wanted it to, then the answer was never the fact that I was drinking or under the influence or, you know, had recently drank. The answer was always in either bad luck or somebody else did something wrong, or they didn't understand or something along those lines. And why can't the rest, you know, why can't my wife just understand, you know, that just because I like to drink and go to the bar all the time doesn't mean that I don't love her, you know? I mean, you can do both, you know, right? I mean, that was the logic in the and world that I lived in, you know. You stay up drinking till 3 o'clock in the morning, you got to be at work at 7 o'clock. You know, as long as I got in the door, I could do my job just fine, right? You know, yeah, my head's pounding and my face is all red and, you can probably smell me three over and I'm slurring my words, but I can still sell over the phone, right? Because my client's not in front of me. They can't smell it. And the danger in that thinking is it's so easy, or at least it was so easy for me to do it. My supreme sacrifice wasn't really thoughts of suicide. My supreme sacrifice was I traded in my entire identity to be a drinker. You know, that's the one thing that I look back on. It's probably the thing that I wonder about the most is, you know, yeah, I was pretty good at selling when I was drinking heavily. How good would I have been had I not been drinking heavily? You know, I was a pretty good dad for the most part when I was drinking heavily. How good could I have been if I wasn't drinking heavily? You know, that was really my supreme sacrifice was, yeah, I'm living in an and world. And my compromise is always, I'll do the first part not so good so that I can do the drinking really good. You know, and how much do we sacrifice in the name of getting a buzz? You know, that was a thing that I still wonder about sometimes today. You know, how great of a dad could I have been had I not been drinking all the time? So.
All right. This is our last paragraph, Roman numeral 30. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
So there's that word never again. It has never been permanently eradicated. And like I said before, you know, never to me means surrender. Means I have to just step back and trust that, nope, not this time either. Because, you know, this one common symptom differentiates me from normal drinkers. I am set apart as a distinct entity. And, you know, I was in school most of my life, and I have been trained and brainwashed to always ask why? And to analyze. And I really want to do that sometimes. Why? Why am I different than other people? I have a lot of friends outside of the program. My husband is a normal drinker who leaves half of his warm beer on the table. And sometimes I watch him taking those drinks with impunity, and I just think, why? But that's surrender, man. You know, I don't know why, but I do know that every time I take a drink, I get the phenomenon of craving. And whatever that reason is, you know, why does anybody have an allergy? I don't know. But I have it. And the only relief that anyone has found is entire abstinence. And that was really scary for me in the beginning. Actually, it can still be really scary for me at times if I get all up in my head about it, which I am wont to do. But I have written at the end of this paragraph, today. Entire abstinence today. That's really all I have to do. This program is one day at a time. And if I don't take a drink today, then I'm not going to get the phenomenon of craving today. And there have been times when I don't think of it as today. I think of it as in the next 5 minutes. If I don't take a drink in the next 5 minutes, then I will be okay. And that's really all I can stomach right now is 5 minutes at a time. And that has worked for me. Entire abstinence just for today, right now. And I cannot do that on my own. If I walk out these doors and never come back, and I've walked out these doors and thought about never coming back, but that's only lasted like 2 or 3 weeks at a time because I get so restless, irritable, and discontent that I absolutely am inches away from a drink. And by the grace of God, I have, you know, wandered back in here before picking one up. And that is just proof to me that I absolutely cannot be abstinent from alcohol on my own. I have to work this program of recovery. I need a spiritual solution. And thank God I found one in this book. I don't know how they wrote it. I really don't. I mean, that's another thing. By the grace of God, they wrote this book and made it so clear and so simple. I heard in a meeting over the holidays that this is a simple program for complicated people. And that is so true. I will make everything just about as complicated as humanly possible. But this is very simple. And all I have to do is keep coming back and take a few suggestions just today, just right now. Thanks.
When I came to the realization of the phenomenon of craving and the mental obsession, and that the only relief was entire abstinence, I was really distraught at that idea. I wish I had brought it with me, but I can remember it pretty well. I was journaling in my rehab, and I wrote a thing that said something to the effect of, I know I have to quit drinking, but my mind keeps screaming at me not to. You know, it tells me things like, you're not going to have fun anymore. You know, even if you are successful in something, you know, eventually it's going to come out that you're an alcoholic and all of it's going to be lost. You know, you're going to be a loser. You're not going to have any friends. You're going to miss out. And all of those things because, you know, I not known any ease and comfort or fun outside of drinking. And you take that away, and I was like, man, life is going to really, really suck with this whole, you know, entire abstinence thing. But the thing I've come to find out is that how much better life is. When I was in, I was probably about 45 days into the program. And just to give you a little background, I kind of went into the program pretty heavy because, you know, I was drinking extremely heavy. At the time I went in to rehab for the second time, I'd already gone for a 30-day stint the prior year and made it about 5 months without drinking. And then I decided that my abstinence or my tolerance was probably down. I could enjoy it again and came back raging. But at that point, before I went into that rehab, I'd spent a month living in my car and then with a buddy who drank just as bad as I did, only up until I lived with him. He was always worse than me, and then I started realizing that I drank just as hard as he did, if not harder. And so I ended up going to a detox center and then into a homeless shelter for about 7 months where I was in their long-term treatment program. And about 45 days into that, my counselor, we were talking and he said to me, he goes, let me ask you something, Joe. Say you didn't have this phenomenon of craving and this obsession of the mind, you know, and you could drink like a normal person. He goes, do you think you would end up being happy? And I was thinking about it. And I just kind of looked up and I was like, you mean to tell me that maybe God made me an alcoholic because I had to have a spiritual program in order to be truly happy? And he was like, well, that's not kind of what I was going for, but yeah, that makes sense. You know, and I think about that now and I think that's true. You know, and I see a lot of the main thing that amazes me about Alcoholics Anonymous is as you get to know people in this program and you hear their stories, I mean, a lot of times these are people that you wouldn't trust with anything while they were drinking. Yet you take away that drink and they're loving, caring people that would do anything for anybody to try and help them. But you get them drinking again and they couldn't care about anybody. Makes me kind of wonder if alcoholics as a whole are just, you know, a little bit more spiritually sensitive than other folks out there. And because we're spiritually sensitive, God blessed us with this allergy that drives us into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous so that we can work a spiritual plan of action to allow us to become the people that we are really meant to be. You know, and I hear people saying I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, and I know what that means today, because I was miserable, you know, in high school and college, and when I was a normal drinker for those first 8 years. And I think the reason was is because I really wanted to help people and really wanted to do good things for people. But I didn't dare because I didn't have a program to bring it out for me. And I didn't, you know, think I had anything to offer to anybody. And so I developed this allergy, and, you know, I probably exploited it about 8 years, 10 years longer than I had to get here, but I got here. And now I have a chance to go out and help other alcoholics, you know, and to see the light come on in their eyes and, you know, have somebody come up to me and say, you know, you said something about 6 months ago that really got me to thinking. And since that time, this and this happened. Of course, I don't remember saying it at all. But the beautiful part is that it happened, you know. My higher powers used me to touch somebody else. And that's something that's completely amazing. So I'm really grateful that I have this phenomenal of craving. You know, when I first came across it, this idea that I was, where does it say that? That differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. That line I really hated, you know, because that meant I was different. I was abnormal. And now it kind of makes me feel like, you know, I'm special. You know, I have something else to offer, because, you know, it's amazing the miracles that happen in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for the people that work the program. You know, the good stuff doesn't happen if you don't work the program, but the awesome stuff does if you do. And that's one of the most amazing things, this phenomenon of craving that I was so heartbroken that I had, because it meant I couldn't have fun anymore, that I could never be cool again, that, you know, eventually I'd be outed and everybody would look down on me and think I'm weak and think I'm whatever. Now it's like probably the greatest gift that I've ever had. And, you know, I know that sounds weird if you're relatively new to the program that someone would say that, but just keep plugging along, because those promises on page 82 or 83 or 83 and 84, I don't know exactly, they're really true. And they looked so foreign to me when I first came, but I wanted them. And now that they're starting to come true and I see them happening for me, and then I see them happening for other people that I know in the program, you know, this craving of phenomena, or this phenomenon of craving, is definitely not a negative thing. You know, it's the little thing that we need to become the people that we really have the ability to become, if we're willing to work the program, and if we're willing to, you know, not use half measures and not try to reorder the steps to our liking, and not take the best and leave, or take the best and leave the rest. You know, if we commit to working this program for all we have, amazing things can happen. And, you know, I have yet to find the part where, you know, I feel like a loser again. And I've yet to find the part where I get outed and everybody looks down on me. The majority of the time they're like, holy cow, that's so awesome, you know. And so, yeah, if you're new, just keep plugging, you know, give the program a shot. You know, the phrase, keep coming, or don't leave before the miracle happens. You know, it sounds really cheesy and really stupid. Maybe just take the attitude that I took when I first started, because I didn't come in and say, you know, that's it, I'm done, I'm quitting forever. I came in and said, you know, I'm going to give this all I got. If I'm going to be here, I'm going to be here. I'm going to give it all I got for a month. And if I don't like it, I'll go back out drinking. And I got to a month point and I was like, well, it's not bad. You know, I'll give it another month, you know. But along the way, I was there, you know. If I was going to be there, I was going to be there. And I gave it all my effort and delayed the decision for the first time, because every other attempt I'd made before that, I looked ahead and said, is it going to be worth it? Yes or no? And if I thought it was going to be worth it, then I would go for it. If I didn't think it would be worth it, then I wouldn't. And that led me inevitably to decide that it wasn't worth it as I was looking forward. But I just decided by some miracle of, you know, God working in my life, I decided to delay judgment until after, for the first time, instead of trying to decide before whether or not it was going to be good or bad. and taking it one day at a time in between, saying, you know, okay, I'll give it one more day, one more day, one more day, see how it goes, see how it goes. And next thing you know, I'm, you know, 2 years and whatever, 9 months or whatever it is into it, and life is amazing. And it's truly awesome, you know. And I thank God so much that I'm an alcoholic, because I wouldn't have the ability to be as happy and joyous and free as I am right now had I never not developed that phenomenon of craving. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so that was our last reading tonight. If y'all help me thank our speakers.
You're awesome.
If you come back next week, we'll be talking about the obsession. So that's when we'll be next week. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any AA-related announcements tonight? Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Will home group members raise your hand? Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? If you want to raise your hand and just give us your first name, we'd really like to welcome you tonight. Any newcomers?
My name's Greg. I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hey.
Greg, welcome.
Welcome. Okay. There is literature over on the table here. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you'd like to purchase a book. The pamphlets are free for the taking. And sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, you can come up and see me after the meeting, and I'll answer any questions you may have about sponsorship. A reminder to smokers to please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. And all of our meetings are recorded, and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, if we can thank our panel one more time. And please feel free to come up and thank them after the meeting. We really appreciate them coming out tonight. Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. It's on 22nd and Colonial, right up the street. It's just a little Mexican place, so y'all come out and join after the meeting if you can. And do I have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs? David.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
Hey, David.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right. And if you'd like to join, we'll close with a word of prayer.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back in works of the world.